David Morrison is a senior scientist at the NASA Astrobiology Institute, where he participates in a variety of research programs in astrobiology, the study of the living universe. Dr. Morrison received his Ph.D. in astronomy from Harvard University. Until he joined NASA, he was the professor of astronomy at the University of Hawaii. Internationally known for his research on the solar system, Dr. Morrison is the author of more than 135 technical papers and has published a dozen books. Among his honors is as a NASA Outstanding Leadership Medal. David Morrison is a senior scientist at the NASA Astrobiology Institute, where he participates in a variety of research programs in astrobiology, the study of the living universe. Dr. Morrison received his Ph.D. in astronomy from Harvard University. Until he joined NASA, he was the professor of astronomy at the University of Hawaii. Internationally known for his research on the solar system, Dr. Morrison is the author of more than 135 technical papers and has published a dozen books. Among his honors is as a NASA Outstanding Leadership Medal for his contributions to dealing with the hazard of asteroid and comet impacts. He is currently president of the International Astronomical Union Working Group on Near-Earth Asteroids and Asteroid 2410. Morrison is named in his honor. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. David, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm fine.
My pleasure. Well, I sure hope the Asteroid 2410, named after you, doesn't get nearly as close as you are with us right now, huh?
Absolutely safe from it.
By the way, I just came back from a couple days in Hawaii, where, of course, you were the professor of astronomy at the university there for years. What a wonderful state. Absolutely gorgeous area.
And a wonderful place to do astronomy.
For sure. James McCanny, Professor McCanny, MS, is a physicist who has spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. He has openly opposed NASA's view that outer space is electrically neutral. McCanny was a faculty member of the physics and mathematics departments of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics. They are the studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and American Geophysical Union. James McCanny. Hi, Jim. How are you?
George.
Always
very well.
Very good, very good. I tell you what we're going to do to get this started. First of all, thanks to both of you for offering your views and your take on Velikovsky's theories and whether you think Velikovsky was right on the button or maybe he was nuts. Who knows? But I tell you what, I'm going to flip a coin because I want each of you to make a little statement first about your particular stand on this before we get into the dialogue tonight. And David, because you were on my show, of course, in August of 2004. James, you're quite a regular on Coast to Coast. I'm going to let David call this coin flip. And if you're right, David, you can decide if you want to go first or second. So would you call heads or tails, sir?
Heads.
The coin is dropping, and it is tails. So, Dave, James, you have a decision to go first or second in your opening remarks.
I'll go first.
All right, first it will be.
To thank Dr. Morrison, we had a brief discussion a few weeks ago when we planned the show, and I appreciate him agreeing to talk to me on the air, and also the staff of Coast to Coast for putting this together. My position here is to, actually in talking to Dr. Morrison, there's probably quite a few things we agree on, and people will find that might be surprised at that, but then, of course, there are going to be topics we disagree on. And my viewpoint here is to take the purest aspect of Velikovsky, because there are so many people running around, jumping up and down, using Velikovsky's name today that really they're adding a lot, they're changing it, they're using Velikovsky's name as a draw, and then doing a bait and switch, so to speak. So what I really want to do here is to present a purist Velikovsky viewpoint, for better or for worse. And Velikovsky, of course, made a lot of mistakes. But I believe that he also had some things that were very groundbreaking in the 1950s. And here is, I believe, what happened. That if you take, for example, George, I'm going to use this example. Say I come up to you, you're wearing a white shirt, black tie, and street shoes. And I say, George, you're wearing a white shirt, a black tie, and tennis shoes.
Mm-hmm.
My total statement is false. But that doesn't mean that you're not wearing a white shirt and a black tie.
True.
And so this is somewhat what has happened with Belkowski. He's made some statements. He's mixed them with other statements that were false. And if you mix it all together, the sum total of what he said, you could easily state as being false. But mixed in there, there were some basic concepts that I want to, in his defense, since he is not here, use as a basis for saying that he discovered some groundbreaking ideas and put them forward. Some of them had already been stated by people in the past, like Ignatius Donnelly. Just quickly, I'll go through my short list here.
Well, let's save that, Jim, as we get into the dialogue, okay?
That's fine, yeah.
But I just wanted you to, you know, take your position on Velikovsky, and you've done so eloquently. Dr. Morrison, your take on this.
I think Velikovsky is an interesting case because he looked like a scientist but wasn't. And a lot of people were confused by this. I think probably the best summary is from Henry Bauer, who wrote the book Beyond Velikovsky, is very well reputed, and said this: Velikovsky displays a lack of understanding of chemistry, physics, and astronomy. He is not only ignorant of the facts, his whole approach is not that of a scientist. He does not weigh his evidence, he does not deduce independent tests of validity, yet he discusses these subjects in a manner that would convey to a layman an apparent familiarity with these fields. A lot of people believed him. When I was in grade school, I first came across Worlds in Collision. There was nobody in my little town to tell me that this wasn't legitimate science. So it's an interesting case of someone who talked like science, but actually there was nothing there.
You were a student of Carl Sagan, right?
Yeah.
Did Carl ever talk about Velikovsky at all?
Oh, a little bit, sure.
And I would assume he would say that Velikovsky was all washed up on this theory.
Well, he was simply wrong. I'm sure he was sincere. I'm sure he worked hard. But his ideas about what happened in the solar system were demonstrably wrong.
Okay. Now, also, as we continue this dialogue, I want both of you to very freely jump in and talk with each other as we do this. I'm going to basically moderate this and ask you questions as we move, but you are more than welcome to talk with each other as well on this. Jim, do you believe, of course, Velikovsky believes that Venus was a captured comet. Is that correct?
That's Velikovsky's main hypothesis, that Venus was a large comet first noticed by the planet Jupiter by the ancients and then meandered through the solar system, first encountering Mars, and claims that the ancients saw the comet extract the atmosphere and water of Mars, claiming that Mars was, prior to that, a blue planet like Earth, and then eventually encountered Earth on two separate occasions, 52 years apart, and then eventually nestled into the orbit where we see Venus today, and lost its properties as being a comet.
Do you subscribe to that part of the theory that Venus was a captured comet?
Well, now, Velikovsky's original story was that Venus was blasted out of Jupiter, but herein lies one of his, as Dr. Morrison states, one of his assumptions or unscientific results based on his belief or the he was looking through the eyes of the ancients through the texts he was reading.
Right.
And on this, I agree with Dr. Morrison that planets don't fly out of other planets. And they simply don't. It's something coming out of Jupiter would be in a gaseous state. I mean, it wouldn't.
Well, didn't
there's other mechanical problems with that process.
Didn't the moon come out of the Earth? And though it wasn't a planet, it's still pretty good size.
Yeah, but Jupiter has a tremendous atmosphere. And so the dynamics, however, in fact, astronomers are still going back and forth over where our moon came from, whether it was captured, whether it was part of the original system with the original planet, or whether something hit Earth and knocked it out, and then Earth reformed into the ball we see today. You know, I don't believe mainstream astronomers have decided on a final scenario for that. I see it all the time going back and forth. It's like every 2 years you hear the other scenario, and then 2 years later you hear the other one. But to answer your question, I do see scenarios. In fact, the last appendix of my weather book, I have a chapter that actually I wrote in 1982 called From Exodus to Voyager 2, the Velikovsky Connection. And what I did is I put forth a scenario based on the comet model that I proposed, which is the plasma discharge comet model, which shows that capture was the process that brought Venus into the solar system. And then the tail drag was what caused the orbital circularization, which occurred, in my estimation, over a period of about 600 years. And this is a scenario. Now, I also look at the planet Venus, and Reginald Newell, a chemist from back in the 80s, made an objective view of Venus, and he said if you just look at it, it's a younger planet. But if you look throughout the solar system, my view is that many of the objects in the solar system came later. At some point they were captured or brought in at a later date. And so I'm a proponent of the capture as a mechanism for some of the members of the solar system. For example, I don't believe Titan, that we're now observing out by Saturn, was an original moon of Saturn that somehow was mm-hmm. captured. And so we have many examples. But back to the Venus scenario, which is what we're talking about tonight, I do see the model working and showing how Venus could become a planet as a large comet. The larger comets have enough gravitational attraction to retain the material they're drawing in. In this plasma discharge comet model, and that's what causes the reduction in orbit, the circularization, and then the two encounters with Earth also would have changed the orbit and certainly would have had a drastic effect on Earth.
David, you believe, of course, Venus formed in the solar system like the other planets, I assume.
Yeah, but let me try to go back to Velikovsky for a minute.
All right.
Instead of Jim's ideas. Velikovsky put together this scenario primarily from studying ancient manuscripts. He found places where different cultures described catastrophic events. Of course, they only knew about what happened right where they were, but he tried to put it together into a global story. And whether it was due to Venus or Mars or whatever, he had, as you said in your introduction, some horrendous events happening on Earth. Floods, volcanoes erupting, the Earth changing its rotation, huge catastrophes. And we can look now at the evidence and ask, did those catastrophes happen? The answer is a flat no. There were no global floods, there were no global eruptions, there was none of this going on. And if it didn't happen, you don't need the theories about Venus.
Well, is it possible they overestimated global, and maybe it was really regional? Maybe we had tremendous regional flooding, maybe going back to where Noah's Ark was, for example, in that area. Maybe we did have some volcanoes that blackened the sky, but only during a certain area. Is that possible?
Sure, sure. All I'm saying is that you can go back. I think you even mentioned in your introduction, Sinai erupted.
Yes.
Well, you know, I've been to Sinai. You can go to Sinai. It has not erupted in the last few thousand years. That you can check these facts. Did it happen? Did the moon's surface become liquid and bubble, the way Velikovsky said? Go down the whole list. The answer is no, it didn't happen.
The theory of Velikovsky, of course, too, is that Venus is 6,000 years old, at least in our solar system, Jim McCanney, or 6,000 years old as a formed planet.
The scenario, the dating that Velikovsky uses, is 1447 B.C. was the first encounter with Earth. So it had to have been in the solar system possibly for hundreds of years prior to that, orbiting, passing by Mars, working its way into a position where it finally crossed Earth's orbit and encountered it. And then the second encounter, according to Velikovsky, was 1395. And he picked these dates. There were many references to a 50-year period between the two encounters. And so that's where he got those dates. And I want to add this also, that dating of past events like this, and there, this is one of the huge quagmires of Velikovsky, and probably where most of the debate back and forth was centered upon, was trying to verify these dates with texts of ancient cultures, with tree rings, with the ice sheet on Greenland, on and on. And so when you get into these type of things, or carbon dating, or dating of any type of activity in the past, this is where an enormous controversy always erupts.
See, part of the thing, too, is, as David points out, that Velikovsky really was not a scientist, really schooled in astronomy or what was going on with planets. He, you know, he practiced psychoanalysis when he lived in Palestine, and, you know, he received a medical degree in 1921. All of a sudden, he becomes this expert in space. I guess that probably hurt his credibility somewhat. We'll be back in a moment with our guest, James McKinney, Dr. David Morrison, as we talk about the theories, Worlds in Collision, of Velikovsky. And welcome to the Velikovsky Story Debate with James McKinney, Dr. David Morrison, right here on Coast to Coast. David, what, if anything, fascinates you about this entire Velikovsky issue? Is there anything there?
Yeah, and one of the things I think is a response to what Jim was just saying about the fact that sometimes it's hard to establish dates, and if there were indeed records of these past catastrophes, I'm sure there'd be a lot of scientific debate on which thing happened at which date and what caused it. But, you know, there isn't any record of it. We have, for instance, ice cores from Greenland and from the Antarctic, in which you can see a layer for every single year. You can determine temperature, you can see if there's volcanic dust, you can see if there's dust coming from events in the sky, and there's nothing anywhere in the last 10,000 years. So if there's no record, then there's nothing to argue about dating.
Astronomically speaking, David, is it possible for an object to get captured, let's say, in our solar system and then become part of it?
Pretty darn hard. No effort, no record that anything like that's ever happened, and it would be very tricky to accomplish. But, you know, scientists don't have a very good record when they say something's impossible. So I'm not going to say it's impossible.
What do you
think?
I'm
going to say, show me the evidence that it ever happened.
James McKinney, what do you think?
Well, therein lies the crux, because scientifically we've only been astute for, a few hundred years, and this Velikovsky interpretation of the ancients saying that Venus was born of Jupiter, some people say Saturn, but basically captured by one of the planets. Nobody was there in modern times. The dichotomy here, however, is that if we use that as a yardstick for all scientific endeavor, nobody was around during the Big Bang either. But we certainly hold that in high regard in some certain circles. But so you have to weigh the evidence, as Dr. Morrison says, and the probability and what is the possibility of this happening. My view in the solar system is to go out and look at the planets and moons, and even the moons, say, of Jupiter are all different. They're right next to each other, but they're all different in composition, in structure, in surface features. Io is a highly volcanic moon, and my way of thinking, that's possibly a new addition, but oddly enough, it's the closest moon to Jupiter, which means that if it was captured, it would have had to work its way past the other three major moons. And so there you're talking about possible close encounters during this capture process. So, and ultimately, nobody was there to see it, so we're really left with the situation, and for that matter, the concept that the solar system all formed at one time 4.5 billion years ago, which is the standard theory today. Of course, nobody was there at that time. And there's many side scenarios that go with that, that the comets were formed and then were thrown out into the Oort cloud. There are many scenarios that standard science uses, and by the same yardstick, nobody was there. But they have, you know, done enough, let's say, subsidiary work so that this appears plausible in the grand scheme of things. And that's what tends to occur in science, is they add and add and add until all of the scenarios seem to fit together. That's why someone like myself coming in with a new concept has a very difficult time even being heard, because you're trying to fit this in place of what is already there. It's not like I'm adding one little thing and I'm changing the whole structure of the solar system that captures the primary mechanism for the formation of planets. You know, you're going against a very large wall, let's say. And but the bottom line is, with Velikovsky, he was not a good scientist. He would have been far, relative to your comment right before the break there, George, he would have been far better off to have just done his humanistic research and then said, okay, scientists, you figure out how this all happened. But he didn't do that. He started saying, well, it must have flown out of Jupiter, and that's where he broke down. He said, well, Venus must have a hydrogen atmosphere because it came from Jupiter. That was wrong. You know, all of these inferences were secondary.
Well, what would have happened, Jim, had he, of course, he based a lot of his theories on the catastrophes that he believes occurred during that period of time. Well, what would have happened had he said that Jupiter was millions of years old and was captured? Do you think more people would have believed him?
You mean that Venus was...
Venus, rather, yeah. Yes.
There again, we don't have records. He based it all on the records of, you know, that our written record only goes back a few thousand years. And that's one of the mysteries, is how we had apparently civilizations prior to this, and what many people think were quite advanced civilizations. And many of the writing and the letters and the words that come down to us apparently came from some previous civilization, because all of a sudden they appear and they have certain structures, and you find them recurring, like the word mu or ATL, like in the South Americans vocabulary, continually repeated, which is reminiscent of Atlantis.
Well, I was going to say, some people believe Atlantis. Zechariah Sitchin, of course, has done his work into the Sumerian texts. Velikovsky reminds me a little bit of Zechariah Sitchin in that they have these theories of catastrophes and events that occurred, except, of course, Zechariah goes a little further and talks about visitations. Velikovsky does not do that. David, if James McCanney, physicist, were presenting the works of Velikovsky before an honored body of other physicists, would they drum him out, or would they sit there and listen and take heed?
Well, I haven't heard everything that Jim said, but from what I've seen, they drum him out.
They would drum him out. Huh?
Jim, he has less credibility than Velikovsky. Velikovsky, at least, was distinguished and tall and gray-haired and spoke with a Russian accent and looked pretty darn good.
The gloves are off.
Actually, I still am active in the scientific world. This May, I'm presenting. I have quite a diverse array of work that I do. I'll be presenting the small aspect of what I do at the American Geophysical Union meeting this May, dealing with X-rays in the solar system, which is something I predicted in 1979. I said comets should exhibit X-rays out to the sunward side, which has been recently discovered. But since then, they've been finding X-rays all over the place. So I do manage to talk. And by the way, when I do talk in the scientific community, I really don't ever bring up Velikovsky. That would be a very small aspect of what I do. I deal with weather the electrical conditions in the solar system, the Sun-Earth connection, and a lot of my work predated what the NASA people have been doing in terms of the vertical electric field. Just the other day, they announced that they have now captured on film the excitation of electrons coming down into nitrogen molecules in the upper atmosphere, which creates sprites, something I've been saying all along. So, but I agree. If I went in front of a group of scientists and started talking about Velikovsky, I wouldn't be there long.
But, do you both agree, as so many astronomers believe, that there might have been an object, a huge object, that hit planet Earth? Let's start with you, David. I mean, you're a PhD, you're a scientist. Do you think something happened to this planet a long time ago?
If you go back far enough, of course, you had to form the Earth. And the Earth formed from collisions of objects, lunar-sized objects. And then we think, we can't ever prove it, but we think that rather late in that accretion of the Earth forming by impacts, it was walloped by something about the size of Mars, and that is what produced the debris that ended up as the moon.
If two cars collided head-on, would it be that kind of a collision?
You'd want them to collide obliquely, so they spin around their center.
And what happened to the other objects?
Well, some of it's in the Earth, and some of it's in the moon. It didn't survive.
And did any of it just leave the solar system, or?
Why, sure, I'm sure a little of it did. But most of it fell back into the Earth, and some ended up in the moon.
Would you have said then that, and let's assume it was lunar size, maybe a little bigger, was Earth a little smaller at that time?
Yeah, I think so. Although, you know, you're right, we don't know the exact amount of material that was lost. But yes, the Earth would have grown by this collision, as it grew from lots of other collisions before that. It's only the last one that you can even guess of understanding.
And Jim, I guess you would concur that you believe we got hit and hit by something large?
No, I lean towards the capture process for our moon. I believe that it's a completely different structure, completely different composition, and like many other objects in the solar system, capture is the best explanation, as it would have been originally captured by, say, one of the outer large planets, meandered through the solar system until it came close to Earth, and then whenever you have a close capture, like the moon to Earth, then you have energy reduction has to come from somewhere, so that it then remains orbiting Earth. But capture, in my way of thinking, I have a chapter in one of the early papers I did back in 1979. It's called the Statistics of Solar System Formation. And it talks about the size distribution of objects, how the asteroid belt is a perfect example of the capture of millions of small objects, and their ability to stay there because there's no planet to accumulate them or sweep them out of there in that region between Mars and Jupiter. If you look at capture as the process and the fact that tail drag circularizes and changes these orbits, then what we see in the solar system is a perfect example of capture. So many of the objects are captured and then brought into the solar system with literally maybe Jupiter and the Sun and maybe one other object being the original primary members of the solar system, everything else coming in by capture at a later date.
How do you handle the argument, Jim, that Velikovsky was not a scientist? He wasn't schooled in planetary science. He wasn't schooled in astronomy.
Well, and therein, too, we still see that today. There's a lot of people running around the Internet today who are causing a great deal of damage to Velikovsky's name, who are not trained scientists also.
But I'm not talking about them. I mean, the fact that Velikovsky did not have this kind of knowledge. He was not, like you, he was not even a physicist.
Correct. And you see errors strewn throughout his work. And just like I used the example of your shirt and tie and shoes at the beginning, there are people who bought everything he said, hook, line, and sinker, and said that everything Velikovsky says is right, and defended it. And this is where some of the craziness occurred in the early days of Velikovsky, because it got to be very personal, very, there were people who would get a hold of astronomers, and once they got their ear, they would have this unending battle of minutia. And I believe Dr. Morrison probably witnessed that also. This is the whole situation that Velikovsky was not a scientist, and he should have just cut the story right in his humanistic findings and said, I'm not a scientist, you guys over there figure this out, and just left it.
Prior to the 60s, David, Dr. Morrison, Velikovsky, of course, was persona non grata on campuses and in colleges. Nobody wanted anything to do with him. Then I guess what happened? After the 60s, he popped back up again?
Right. But not because scientists were pushing him.
They didn't have their arms open for him.
No, and it's kind of ironic because he made claims, or people made claims for him, that somehow the results of the space program were confirming his predictions. And, you know, that just wasn't true. In fact, it goes the other way around. There are a lot of things that he suggested in 1950 that were at least superficially plausible then, but by the 70s it was clear that they hadn't happened. So it's kind of a strange, it's a part of this Velikovsky phenomenon,
had
that he had this resurgence.
Had he written the book as fiction instead of nonfiction, and maybe tried to turn it into a thriller, maybe he would have had better luck with it.
Well, I've always been amused at what some of the reviewers for the publisher said, that basically, well, you know, this isn't right, but it's a good story, and I bet you'll make lots of money by publishing this book.
And it was a good seller, wasn't it?
Sure was.
Now, you say you read the book when you were a youngster.
Yeah.
When did you start changing your mind? Because you believed him, right?
Actually, I was a little befuddled by the book, even when I was in the eighth grade. And certainly by the time I got to college, it was quite evident to me that this just, there wasn't any there.
Did it steer you into college? I mean, was this something, this theory, was it on your mind when you went into the sciences?
No, and in fact, well, later in my career, I've gotten very interested in planetary catastrophism and collisions of comets and asteroids hitting the Earth and all that. I actually did a poll of a lot of my colleagues, the leaders in this revolution in thinking of a more dynamic solar system. And none of them had anything positive to say about the influence of Velikovsky. And about a third of them actually put it the other way around. They said it was harder for an academic to suggest a catastrophist event like an asteroid hitting the Earth, because they kind of, people would smirk and say, oh, that's Velikovskian. So it actually, I think, went the wrong way. It discouraged people.
Yet today, and you, here you are, an expert on near-Earth asteroids, we can't really laugh about this anymore, can we? About the possibility that this planet can get hit by something.
I hope not. It's certainly been hit in the past. There's every reason to think it will be in the future. Just, we hope not on our watch.
Jim, as you continue to look at these theories of Velikovsky, and of course there's some you hold on to, some you do not, I mean, what's the future hold for this? I mean, is it going to go anywhere, or are we going to have to come up with new alternative thoughts and theories?
Well, here's what I believe, and this will be borne out possibly someday if we witness the capture of a large comet, which then becomes, say, a moon of another planet, or in fact another planet itself, by the process that I've suggested. Only then will this concept that Velikovsky brought in come back, and at that point it will become clear. Now, the comet Hale-Bopp came through and lost about half of its orbital period in a period of 6 years, and this is something that when it first came in, remember Brian Marsden of the Smithsonian said that this comet is so large that it will not have its orbit changed at all because of jetting. That's the typical dirty snowball comet model method for altering an orbit, because we know comets alter their orbits. But he said this one was so big that jetting could not possibly be a factor. But on a daily basis, we watch the ephemeris changing, and over the
period... There's no mystery to that, Jim. We know that happened because it passed close by Jupiter. and it behaved exactly as you'd expect for something under Jupiter's gravity. There wasn't jetting or any other mysterious thing. It was just plain old solar system dynamics.
Right, but on when it was not close to Jupiter, it also was changing its orbital ephemeris. And I remember pulling it down on a daily basis, watching it change, and it reduced its orbit by a considerable amount when it was not near Jupiter. So I understand what you're saying.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to continue with this debate, this discussion in a moment. And then in our last hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well. And those of you who have computer fast blast capabilities, at the end of next hour, I'm going to ask you between the two here, James McCanny and Dr. David Morrison, if you believe in Velikovsky's theory or not after what you've heard and listened to. I'm George Norrie. Coast to Coast continues.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Coast AM with George Norrie.
We're going to continue our discussion with James McCanny and Dr. David Morrison in a moment about Velikovsky. We'll also get Dr. Morrison's take on James McCanny's theories and vice versa. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. To Dr. Morrison, Venus is a puzzling planet. I mean, it rotates, for example, clockwise. Only planet in our solar system to do so. Why is that?
I talked before about how when the Earth formed, there was a lot of collisions going on with things more or less lunar-sized. And we have to presume that Venus got bonked by something on the rear side that slowed down and slightly reversed its spin. It's not quite the only one. Pluto and Uranus both are knocked off on their side, too. And apparently this is just the result of stochastic random events that were part of this chaotic formation of the solar system, events that happened 4.5 billion years ago.
Jim, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's odd that they have to assume the thing they're denying about what happened to Earth, and that is that something came in and affected it. Only we're talking about time frames, and there again, nobody was here 4.5 billion years ago. I don't buy the all-at-one-time scenario. For example, if you look at the Laplacian scenario, that's what we're talking about, the orbital dynamics show that the objects farther out in the solar system move at a slower velocity than the objects inward. So to my way of looking at this, if you actually follow it and do a computer modeling, all of the planets would spin retrograde due to the way these would form, due to the fact that as they coalesced, the due to the fact that the outer objects move with less velocity, a slower velocity. So they would actually spin backwards of what we see today, and all the moons would move in retrograde orbits.
But, you know, a lot of very good scientists have developed very elaborate computer models and calculated that, and none of them agree with what you just said.
Well, I do understand that, but I've done this also, and I see that they would form a retrograde orbit. But I think the biggest issue here is that there are so many anomalies in the solar system. The moon's orbit is at 6 degrees relative to the Earth's orbit. The Mercury lies on an inclined orbit. It is the closest to the sun, so one would imagine that it should have the most perfect orbit.
Why? I don't think that's obvious at all.
Well, if it all formed in one plane, I don't see the members of the solar system looking at all the same. We find moons with entirely different composition right next to each other. And I've watched this myself as all of these things have been discovered since the probes first started going out, the Pioneers and the Voyagers, and that every time there's something that comes up that's different, and I've sat in the meetings where the scientists have been watching the data for the first time, and inevitably what they do is they correspond this data to the 4.5 billion year old scenario. So which came first, the chicken or the egg?
But nobody made up 4.5 billion years. That's what you get by measuring the age of the Earth, of the Moon, of Mars, of meteorites. That's the age they all come out with.
Well, I understand that. What I don't understand, for example, about, say, moon rocks, is that that's just material that has landed on the Moon from falling around outer space. If we didn't have an atmosphere on Earth, the first layering on top of the Earth would be just stuff that randomly fell on Earth. And so that's the case with the moon. So what?
But no, it isn't. The surface of the moon, the regolith, the garden stuff that's been broken up by impacts, is something between 3% and 5% external material, which you can identify, and the rest is lunar rock that's been churned up and broken in this process.
That was always there, you mean, from its inception?
Yeah, you know, you have a target of rock, and it's hit by other things coming from space, and you end up with a mixture of the two, but it's 95% moon and 5% external.
Now, Jim, let me ask you this. If you take Velikovsky's theories out of any of your equations, I mean, do some of your theories work without Velikovsky involved?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is, you have to understand, I'm here tonight to try and put forth a scenario that would make sense. It does not prove that Velikovsky's Venus happened, and my theories stand on their own. They don't depend on Velikovsky. When I developed these, I didn't even know who Velikovsky was. So you have to understand that it's just that at a later point I said, you know, this kind of fits this scenario of being captured. And so I actually altered Velikovsky's scenario to show how a planet could become captured, how the tail drag would bring it into a circular orbit. Obviously, if it's in the plane of the planets and migrating inward, it will encounter any planets in its way until the orbit becomes circularized. As the orbit becomes circularized, the tail production drops off because it's now in an equipotential region of the solar system. So what happened is I developed all my theoretical work, and then later somebody said, you know, it sounds like this Velikovsky scenario, in which case I started looking into it, and that's in a sense why I'm here. The other reason I'm here tonight is because I see some of the base concepts that Velikovsky came up with. For example, the catastrophism in the solar system, the rapid evolutionary change, the interpretation of chronology of history. In fact, many Egyptologists have now changed their chronology, not the same as Velikovsky, but they have migrated the dates. The origin of coal and oil, some of these issues that I think Velikovsky brought out are very interesting. And then you add on all of his other stuff, that's what really causes the quagmire with Velikovsky. But
is there anything Dr. David Morrison that Velikovsky said that makes sense, in your opinion?
No.
Nothing.
And I think it's really not too surprising. Look, can I just say a little bit about how science is done? Because you have quite a few people, I think, on your show who are loners who say, you know, I have worked for 20 years on this theory, and this is what
sure.
it is. And it's not the way science works. Science is very competitive, very interactive. A research scientist is every day talking to colleagues. Most of the things people publish, they publish with 2, 3, 4 authors because you need complementary talents. They criticize each other. They interact. It's an enterprise that takes lots of smart people and lots of new data working together. And a person like Velikovsky who says, you know, I thought of this in 1940, I worked on it for 10 years, I wrote a book, and this is the answer, that's as unlikely to be right as if somebody who'd never picked up a ball went out in the Super Bowl and thought they were going to, you know, make the winning points. It just doesn't work that way.
What are the odds, do you think, of Velikovsky by chance being correct? 5%? 10%?
Nil.
Really? Okay. Jim, I don't think you'd go on and say that, would you?
Well, there again, if he's right, the probability is 1. And for just as the same example, if there are 2 planets whose orbits overlap, the probability that they're going to have an interaction someday is 1. So the point here is that we were not here 3,500 years ago, and so in that respect, nobody can say that Velikovsky was right, but on the other hand, standard science, by the same yardstick, can't say it did not happen.
All right, here's a question for both of you. We'll start with you first, Jim. If Velikovsky's right, if he's wrong, so what? I mean, what does this mean if he's right or wrong? I mean, what does this mean to us?
Well, it means that the solar system is dynamic, that these, obviously we only have 9 major planets, so this doesn't happen every day. That it happened in the past 3,500 years, if he were right, would be quite an amazing event, but not totally out of the question because we have 40-some major moons around the planets. So this is happening on an ongoing basis, somewhat regularly, in the history of the solar system. If you take that over a 4.5-billion-year period, this doesn't happen every day. So I think it's incorrect for science and astronomers to assume that because we have not seen something, because we have not seen something in the past 300 years, that it's not possible. For example, take the concept of huge comets. We have not seen the big comets. Now, the ancients talk about the big comets, whether you're by Velikovsky's story or not, totally removed from that. The ancients talk about gigantic comets.
You mean like planetary size?
That stretch, the tails stretch from one side of the heavens to the others. And they talk about the Hopi Indians have legends saying that the blue comets are the dangerous ones, the ones that fluoresce. In the 1990s, scientists began to realize that some comets fluoresce. They produce more light than comes from the sun. So slowly some of these things are being discovered. But we haven't seen the big comets in the last 300 years. And now we have discovered another planet. NASA has many programs on the table and upcoming to look for roving planets around our solar system. And they're building satellites, sending them up.
Really? I've never heard of any.
Well, there's one it's called the New Horizons probe, sending out to Pluto. Here's a article is written by Alan Stern, Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. It says the evidence for existence of Planet X is compelling. They said they're looking for what they call the Kuiper Cliff, which is a drop-off of Kuiper objects at around the orbit of Pluto. And this was published in Icarus, Volume 160, page 32. And they are looking for basically what they're calling a Planet X-type object that no one has ever seen yet. And
they were looking for this edge in the Kuiper Belt.
Correct. And
that's not Planet X.
Well, it's the term he uses. I'm reading what Alan Stern said. I'm not putting words in his mouth, and they said this will be launched in 2006, and it won't reach Pluto until 2015. So they are looking for objects out there. There's another satellite in 2008 that will be launched looking for faint, diffuse water clouds at the far reaches of the solar system, which would be very large comets.
Well, let's go back for just a minute, and let's assume Velikovsky was partially right, that there were some catastrophes on the planet, maybe not global, but there were some. But maybe they weren't caused because of Venus. Maybe they were caused by this planet X that is on this very strange elliptical orbit and comes around, as Zechariah Sitchin writes, every 3,600 years. Could you take that as a possibility, David?
I don't know of any evidence at all that there's any such planet on that sort of orbit.
And
so, it's pulling it out of a hat, deus ex machina. I don't see that at all.
So there's
you need to work with data. You need to work with the information that you can go out and measure.
Right. In this same article that I'm reading by Alan Stearns, he's saying that they are beginning to look for these, but the Kuiper Belt is just too far away for us to get a decent view. We need to get out there and have a look before we can say anything about that region, and it won't be possible for another decade at least. So what he's saying is there's a limitation on viewing power. When they found Sedna, it was by accident. They were looking for near-Earth asteroids, and they found this. They programmed the search engine to look for slow-moving objects.
And they have now said, though, that Sedna is not an extra planet, right?
Well, there again, they've invoked, many astronomers said that capture, or the reverse of capture, being thrown out of the solar system, has to be invoked to explain Sedna. But there again, this is up in the air. They've discovered a tenth planet. It has apparently terrestrial planet-type properties, but there's very little known about it at this point. But explaining how it got out to where it is, and then I just read a write-up by Frank Drake, who is changing the...
He heads up SETI, right?
SETI. He's changing the ET equation, the Drake equation, and to quote him, he says, he cites that rogue planets completely without stars wandering throughout interstellar space, which might possess internal radiation capable of generating the necessary heat to support life. This is Frank Drake. And the reason he's changing one factor in the Drake equation is because of the new observation of many rogue planets without a star, without a mother star attached to. So clearly NASA is looking and they're finding. The point being that the original point I was making is that we don't know, and Dr. Morrison is right. You can't speculate based on what you don't see. But they're starting to find things and go, there are more things out there. And for every one you find, there's 100 more that you know are out there that you can't see.
Yeah, it's great. That's part of scientific discovery. And this whole business of Sedna and the other objects in the Kuiper Belt is really neat that we're finding them. But they're in the Kuiper Belt. I mean, they're not your kind of thing that's coming into the inner solar system.
Well, the one thing that I've been myself working on, and unfortunately I do have to work by myself because of the ostracism in the space science community, but what I have been working on is what I call the search for extra solar system objects. And this would be anything of a large size, say a small moon or larger, that might come into the solar system. Not all of them come into the inner solar system. They may just graze the outer solar system and pass by. But the idea is that the structure of the solar system as we know it, the 9 planets and the 40 moons that are all here, and that's all there is, even the Kuiper objects weren't known about, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. I forget when they started finding all of these. So it's like the people in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, they thought that the mountains held up the firmament, and they didn't know anything was beyond there. And that's where we are in astronomy. We're just starting to look out and get the equipment to look out. So it's not a criticism of astronomy, but we have to understand that maybe there's things out there that we don't know about, we don't understand, and we haven't seen yet. And so
I fully agree with that, but until you do see something or some data or some indication, it's just not very useful to speculate.
Great. But the point is, NASA does have programs in place, and they are going out farther to look for these things. If they thought that there was a vast void out there with nothing, they wouldn't be doing all of this. I believe there's about 5 satellites going up right now looking for planets out there, not only around other stars, but in the near solar system region.
Most of that work actually is still done by ground-based telescopes.
True. That's true. And they're getting better techniques with it, but
right.
Sedna was discovered with a 32-inch mirror, I understand. So that's not huge compared to, the big telescope.
Is there anything out there, David, that just baffles you out there in the solar system specifically?
Baffles me?
Yeah.
I guess if I rephrase that a little, the place that I really wish I understood better is Saturn's moon Titan, because that European Huygens probe that went into the atmosphere
yes.
of Titan a couple months ago revealed an amazing world. A world that actually has erosion, but it's based on methane, not water.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange place. I don't know if baffle is the right word, but it would be wonderful to understand better how this other planet works with a different fluid, methane instead of water.
Did that surprise you when it took those kinds of photos and revealed what it did see?
Well, you don't know what to expect the first time you go, and we knew there should be methane there. But I guess I didn't really expect pictures of river valleys.
No, not oceans of methane. No, that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. What does methane look like in a liquid form?
It's a clear liquid.
It is. I mean, could the average person determine the difference between that and water if you just looked at it?
No, but it would be pretty darn cold.
Yeah, it sure would. Stay with us. We'll continue this discussion, open up the phone lines next hour, and then at the top of this hour, though, right before we are done with this hour, I'll open up Fast Blast, and I'll have you vote on whether you think Emmanuel Velikovsky, based on what you're listening, was right on or way off. And I'm back with our friend, Dr. David Morrison and James McCanny. David, what do you think Venus looks like? Long time ago, the Soviets then were able to land a probe and got a little picture there. But what do you think Venus looks like now?
Well, most of what we know about Venus actually has come from the Magellan orbiter, the satellite that we put into orbit around Venus with a very powerful radar and mapped the entire planet at high resolution. So we have actually a better maps of Venus in some ways than we do of Earth. And it's a very, very interesting planet. It's got a different kind of geology from either the Earth or Mars. It appears to have a kind of episodic geology. And it looks like there was a major episode of volcanism about 500 million years ago, plus or minus 100 or so. And then it's been fairly quiescent since then. But it's just its own thing. Every planet has its own personality,
Too hot for water to still be there?
Oh, yes. The atmosphere is 100 times bigger than our atmosphere. Very oppressive, very hot, sulfuric acid clouds. Not the kind of place you want to go visit. But for the geologists, hey, they want to see what the interior is like, and you can tell that from these radar pictures.
Was Earth like that at one time?
Nope.
Never.
We always had water. That was what was so nice. We wouldn't be here talking about it if we weren't on a water world.
And you know what? I believe, as you probably do, that Europa has water.
Sure does.
Frozen, but it's there.
Hey, it has liquid water. There's a frozen crust, but underneath the liquid in Europa is probably about twice as much as all the oceans of Earth put together.
Could be some little critters in there, huh?
I sure wish I knew.
Do you believe there is life out there, David?
Well,
somewhere
out there, sure. I mean, it's inconceivable when you have a universe full of stars and planets that we're the only one with life. But I think that's kind of a trivial statement. The real issue is, what's it like? Can we find it? Can we actually identify an inhabited world, either in our solar system or beyond? Just saying it as though, well, yes, there has to be life, hasn't gotten anywhere. I want to find out.
Well, absolutely. And you're a booster, I'm sure, with our space probes and everything else. We should continue to go out into space, don't you believe?
Sure.
Jim, you know, you've got revolutionary theories. You've taken Velikovsky's and you've put them into your own, and you've taken it a little further. But you don't get the support that I'm sure you wish you would. Does that disappoint you?
No. In a sense, yes, because you have to remember, I still do work with scientists on, like, say, aspects of what I do, like the X-rays in the solar system or the weather work that I do. Actually, it's very interesting to see the people in the, say, every American Geophysical Union conference now is filled with talks about electric conditions in the solar system. We've seen electrical activity where it's believed, for example, the Galaxy 5 satellite was destroyed by an electrical discharge in outer space. So many of these things are being confirmed. But the reality is that I'm in this for the long term and always have been. I've ridden through tremendous adversity, and what I see happening in the space science world is they are migrating towards my theoretical structure, whereas mine has stayed the same for a good 25 years. And it's based on a very simple fact that is very difficult to measure, and that is that there is an excess current of protons in the solar wind, and that powers the electrical nature of the solar system. And that's what drives a lot of our weather. The solar flares, of course, when they come out, are primarily protons, and scientists don't really understand that. I have concepts that deal with fusion in the surface layer of the sun, whereas mainly scientists today believe that fusion is in the core.
Well, let me ask you this, Jim. You know, you go against the grain. Why is that? I mean, what is it that you know that all these other scientists don't?
Well, when I was looking at comets back in the 70s, and I was trying to incorporate these into my the electromagnetic nature of things, and I started playing with electric fields and magnetic fields, I began to learn some of the mistakes that scientists had made. Like one of the criticisms of Velikovsky was that if there were electrical fields around planets, they would go flying off in a million miles an hour. And this just wasn't true. What I learned was that the electrical effects only work on the very smallest particles. They don't work on planetary objects, so that the planetary-sized objects can move with very large electrical concentrations and not be affected. The gravitational action still works very much the same. The only difference is with the large comets, when they draw in the tail material, it causes a drag on the orbital dynamics of the comet nucleus and causes its orbit to circularize and become dropped into a lower orbit. So these are very simple fundamental principles, and you find that I see this all the time in satellite data. For example, the SOHO satellite many times shows an X-ray signature when the electron count drops significantly, many times to zero. And what's going on is that spacecraft is actually charging just like a comet nucleus. It's the very same process. So this process is universal. It also allowed me back in 1979 to discover a principle which probably, in terms of fundamental physics, is one of my most important contributions, which will be seen someday, and that's the induced electric dipole redshift, which is a redshift induced by the non-uniform electric field around a fusion star, or a fusion galactic nucleus or whatever. And I have to put myself into perspective in that these things have been presented to the scientific community and they've chosen to ignore them.
But Jim, doesn't it bother you? You said it. Fundamental to your thinking about the solar system is this net charge in the solar wind. And there have been literally dozens of satellites mirrored space all the way out through the solar system that have specifically measured it, and they find no net charge in the solar wind. Doesn't that bother you?
How can you measure the net charge flowing out of the sun with a single spacecraft?
You measure the electrons, and you measure the protons, and you measure the helium atoms, and they're all there.
Well, the solar flares, by their very nature, are primarily positive so the overall solar wind may have a certain composition, but the net current flow out of the sun has an excess of positive charge. And when you look at the effects that occur that result from this solar capacitor being built up, you start to see all of the things that I'm talking about.
I can only say there are hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists who built instruments and flown spacecraft, and none of them agree with that.
Well, the other thing that I see, and I've watched this as I'm familiar with spacecraft design, and none of them, to my view, have ever included the ability to measure their own electric field. And the problem here is that the spacecraft is not grounded. There is no ground in outer space, so you cannot measure your own electric field. You have to have a secondary spacecraft looking at it from a distance to watch the current flows that occur when a solar flare comes by. And like I just said, you can see this in some of the data, like with the SOHO spacecraft, that as the electron count drops down, actually what's happening is the spacecraft is charging up to a negative potential. There's actually an increase in electrons at the spacecraft, and that's what's causing the local X-ray signature. But the count on the electrometer actually is showing that the electron count is going down, which is not what is happening around the spacecraft. The electron count is actually going up around the spacecraft.
Well, let me ask you both this. I'll start with you, David. If you had an opportunity to have met Velikovsky, what would you have asked him?
Well, I did meet him.
Did you get an audience with him, or just
with a group of people at a meeting, heard him talk. I didn't really have any questions to ask him. I was just fascinated to see him. He was a rather charismatic, old world kind of guy.
And was he believable?
No,
he wasn't.
No,
you guys didn't throw tomatoes at him or anything, did you?
No. But you know, he asserted that all these catastrophic things had happened, never mind why, never mind if it's Venus or Mars. He said they'd happened, and by that time, in the middle 70s, it was quite clear they had not. We'd mapped out the history of Earth. It wasn't his fault. When he wrote it in 1950, he didn't know. But subsequently, evidence had come along.
And he just never changed.
Right.
Yeah.
Or just not.
How about you, Jim? If you had a chance to meet Velikovsky, would you ask him anything?
I would ask him why he attempted to develop science when he clearly was venturing off into a region that he was not versed in. And I would ask him also, I feel the fundamental flaw was he used, scientific theories which did not, he extended them, he changed them, he said this must be true. He provided certain things that should be tested. And looking in retrospect, that's where much of the problems occurred. And like I said, his fundamental concepts, if we find out Venus is a younger planet, as some people they look objectively at it, they don't believe that the greenhouse effect is the cause of the high temperature of Venus, which would only lead to the implication that it's a younger planet. I would say, why did you venture off into the scientific world? Why didn't you just stop while you were ahead, so to speak? I would also ask more about Mars. I think Mars is the very, very a planet with many quagmires, in that we see pristine riverbeds and water signatures on Mars from the satellite pictures, yet there's no ocean or water or atmosphere. And one of my criticisms has been that you need an atmosphere to hold the water in place. And so Mars, they say, well, maybe the ocean just sank into the ground. which I don't find believable, but then what happened to the atmosphere? Did that sink in the ground also? So this actually led NASA and related scientists to propose that a big solar flare came out from the sun and stripped the atmosphere off.
You don't need that. The atmosphere will leak away anyway, because Mars is only 11% the mass of the Earth.
But how did it accumulate it in the first place, then?
Same way the Earth did, from all the stuff that made it up. It's just that it aged rather rapidly while the Earth was able to hold on to ours.
The only problem is these riverbeds are pristine. They are like the day the water left.
Not when you get close, as we find when we put the rovers down. It's one thing to say it looks pristine from 200 miles up and another to get down on the surface.
But the rovers are nowhere near these riverbeds.
No, but they are looking at places, and you really do get a different perspective on the ground, no matter how good the cameras up in space are.
Well, I would think a lot of these features would have just been totally covered, like the Sahara Desert, which only a few thousand years ago. Of course, we have a lot more wind activity, but you see on Mars tremendous dust storms that actually rival anything we have on Earth. And we know that there were features on the Sahara Desert a few thousand years ago that are completely covered up. So why are there regions of
Mars that are completely covered up with sand dunes, too, where you can't see what was underneath?
But still, it appears to me that everything is very fresh there.
In some places, where the wind has swept away the sand instead of depositing it.
But it's still, Mars still appears to be a planet that very much has recent activity. For example, the methane ammonia that has been recorded there, this is going back and forth right now. Some people are saying it's a claim to be a biological life there, but other people are looking at that as a result of volcanism, something that you wouldn't expect from Mars, being an old hulk of a planet. So the fact is that they have measured ammonia, methane, and those type of gases, which are signatures of volcanism. So,
just methane, I think. And as you say, the methane is quite a recent discovery and potentially very exciting.
So, at any rate, I find Titan 2 to be a very interesting. Let me ask you this, Dr. Morrison. Do you think Titan could have formed somewhere else and then been captured by Saturn?
Because I don't see why. It's in a perfectly ordinary orbit around Saturn. Saturn has lots of other satellites, too. No reason to think it came from somewhere else.
But the atmospheric conditions, the planetary composition, seems to be foreign to the planet Saturn.
I don't think so.
Jim, let me ask you, and then you, David, in the last minutes we have here before phone calls. Jim, do you see anything happening to the planet, anything coming by that could disrupt us in the near future?
The planet Earth, you mean?
Yes.
I don't have any data, and of course we can go over this a number of times with people going around saying that I'm saying something's coming in that will devastate Earth. I believe that change has occurred in the past, but unless there is sound data, I'm not going to make any predictions. I don't pick dates. And no, there's no indication right now. However, there is always a possibility. We've seen comets come in and approach Earth, only fairly large comets, only to be seen a few weeks before they come near the sun or the inner solar system. So these things can sneak up on us. So I think that it's something that if something major happens, we may not have a lot of notice.
All right. Do you believe that too, David? Would this happen? Will it be quick?
Hey, I agree with everything you said, with one exception. The biggest things we're talking about happening are being hit by something 20 or 30 miles across. And that would admittedly screw up the planet pretty bad.
Yes, it would.
But, you know, it would screw up the environment. It doesn't change the orbit or the spin or the magnetic field or anything like that. But, boy, we don't want to be living on Earth when it gets hit.
No. No, no, no. We wouldn't see the sun for a long time. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
All right, I'll tell you what. We're going to open up the phone lines. And I tell you, when you do call, direct your question either to Dr. David Morrison or James McCanny. Let us know that. It'll be a little easier. And I'm going to open it up now to just any general questions you have about space and science that happens to be the expertise of both of them. Those of you who have fast blast capabilities, what you've just heard, of course, has been a debate between James McCanny and David Morrison as they talk about the theories of Velikovsky, who believes, of course, that Venus was captured. So you tell me in fast blast if you believe Velikovsky was right or wrong. Simple as that, based on what you've heard tonight. And if you need to email me, of course, it's always George at coasttocoastam.com. So the fast blast is open. I will have the results at the end of next hour, right before we go off the air here. But we'll open up the phone lines, pure space questions for our two guests, of course, David Morrison, Dr. David Morrison, and physicist James McCanny. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with your phone calls and then right at the end, the fast blast questionnaire. Jim or David, do we know if Einstein, wrote to Velikovsky? Did they converse at all?
Velikovsky met Einstein in Europe, where they were co-editors of a magazine for the university where they were both residing at the time, and then they carried that friendship forward. They were both at Princeton, of course, until Einstein died, and it is said that Worlds in Collision was the one book that was opened on Einstein's desk when he after he passed away. And my own read on that is that Einstein was working on unified field theory and the post work from the general relativity work. And I think he found something fascinating in the idea that there was electricity or the electric fields, because in Einstein's last personal work out of my later years, he criticized his own general relativity theory for not including the electromagnetic fields and only including gravity. So I believe that's my own read on it. So let's put it that way.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our wildcard line, first of all. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Where are you calling from?
Florida, actually Miami.
All right, welcome, and who would you like to address your question to?
Actually, both of them.
All right, let's pick Dr. Morrison first, just for order. Go ahead.
Okay. George, thanks again for having a wonderful show.
Oh, that's okay, thank you.
As far as Velikovsky is concerned and his scientific values go, modern science is based on three things: identification of a subject as well as its variables, which is a necessarily evil, touching on the arrogance of prediction that actually shouldn't be present until that hypothesis is proven. The second thing being a proven outcome of a hypothesis, and the third being the train of logic that got you there. And therefore, with his studies going on, he was a student of the social sciences, which is a science and lends to his actual logical aspect of thinking. With all that being said, the actual question I have, it references a show that you had on a few weeks ago, about the moon and the aspect that the dark side of the moon is mainly, aluminum? And I think that the light side of the moon has a basic, iron dusting, I think was said. And how does that actually all play into Velikovsky's theory?
Well, David, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, briefly, the moon shows Velikovsky was wrong. Of course, there is no light side and dark side. The moon rotates, and all sides of the moon are more or less alike in composition. But the main thing is it's very old. Nothing much has happened on the moon, no melting or anything like that, in the last 3 billion years. So it just plain wasn't involved in any sort of cosmic cataclysms.
Jim?
The ancients in the Bible, and this is apart from Velikovsky, there's many references to the moon turning to blood, which might imply volcanic flows being witnessed by people looking up from Earth. So you know, these are, once again, ancient descriptions. So what did that really mean? Was there something in the atmosphere that caused the moon to look red? You have the biblical references to red in the rivers, the rivers turning to blood in the Exodus event. But there's one thing that concerns me about the moon, and that is the orbit at 6 degrees. There's a process in celestial mechanics that if an object is below the ecliptic, all of the rest of the planets pull up on it just slightly, and if it's above the ecliptic on the other side of its orbit, then all the planets pull down. So over billions of years, this would work the moon up into the plane of the planets in its orbit. So it would be interesting to do a simulation to see how long it would take the moon to be pulled up into the ecliptic by this process. And it's one of those things on my list of things to do that I haven't done yet. But
I think you'll find it's billions of years. The effect of that pull is to cause the orbit to precess, not to get into the same plane.
But it does pull up. But at any rate, I just thought that was an interesting aspect to the moon. But the moon, other than I don't recall, just to refer to Velikovsky, I don't remember him talking specifically about the moon being thrown out of an orbit, although I don't remember all the passages from Worlds in Collision, just to refer to Velikovsky himself. But if something came by, you would expect it, something big like, say, Venus, you would expect it to cause some alterations if it came that close to Earth. How did it miss doing something to the moon? But there again, unless you were there and saw the dynamics of everything, the moon is 250,000 miles away, and to cause the kind of effects Velikovsky is talking about on Earth, it would appear that Venus would have to be much closer to cause the polar shift, the tidal waves, the mountain building, that type of thing.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from San Francisco.
Hello, John.
AFFO.
Who's your question for?
Dr. Morrison, and the first statement, I think they should make this program required listening. And two is, there's a 5-volume set called Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. And in there, first published in the late 20s, early 30s, they claim that there's asteroids in Saturn's rings. And also, they say that the oldest planet is the furthest one out. In other words, at one time, Mars was in our orbital ring until a planet was formed and pushed all the other planets out one orbital ring. What does Dr. Morrison think of something like that?
It doesn't make much sense to me, but I don't know the source.
This is a lecture supposedly given by Jesus.
Well, I'm not going to speak to Jesus one way or another, but I don't think he's normally claimed to be a great scientist.
Right. But it was the discussion was on the formation of our solar system. So I'll just let it hang out there.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate your comments. Next up, first-time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Thanks for hosting such a beautiful show. My name is Audrey. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome, Audrey.
I have a question for, I believe it's James.
Yes.
I actually emailed you some photos, George. I don't know if you got them, but I'm working on my computer right now, so I'm not currently listening to you online. But I'm going to go ahead and try to shoot these photos over to you. For my question, James, there was a bright star that looked a lot like Venus that was out around 3:30 a.m. Over the past summer. And I decided to take some photos of it, and what showed up on my camera was not what looked or appeared to be at all Venus. And interestingly enough, I really never knew anything about Planet X until I kind of got these photos. I don't know if it's extraterrestrial or intelligent light force that, you know, had possibly been some type of hologram in the sky. But I have some photos of the sun, what it appears to look like the sun, and what appears to look like Planet X. Sounds kind of bizarre and crazy. That's why I'm going to go ahead and try to fast-blast you these photos, George, so you can go ahead and take a look at them and tell me what you think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Unfortunately, I won't be able to look online during the show, but taking photographs of objects with cameras, many times you get internal reflections. There's a whole host of situations that occur when you take photographs, internal reflections which cause ghost images in the picture. So without looking at them, and of course analysis of photos is a whole area of study, but I'm not sure if this may have been Jupiter, and of course without knowing a bit more detail, it's hard to comment. But I know I get pictures, people send pictures all the time, and this happens, I'm sure, with astronomers, Dr. Morrison, too. People are sending them pictures that they believe are a certain thing, and it's hard to know many times if you're not there saying, oh, this is what this effect is or whatever. And over the phone on a show like this, it's very difficult to imagine what might have occurred here, so... Unfortunately, I don't have an answer.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi,
George, could you turn up the... Have your engineer turn up the sound a little for me? I'm having trouble hearing Jim.
Jim, okay.
Oh.
All right.
This is Neil from east of the Rockies.
Hi, Neil. Go ahead.
Yeah, my first question is about the moon. I'm sure you guys have seen the video of the perspective on the moon as the Earth rises above the horizon. And I was wondering, since the moon always faces, the same side of the face of the moon is always towards the Earth, how can that be? Because I would think that it would just sit there and spin very slowly in the same spot. If you're on the moon looking up, you'd see the Earth spinning in the same spot. You wouldn't move horizontally or vertically. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
If those pictures were taken from a satellite in orbit around the moon, so it's the motion of the Apollo capsule that you see reflected in the rising.
Okay, very good. And I'm also wondering, how dense is the actual atmosphere on the Mars? Because if there's no atmosphere at all, there wouldn't be no sandstorm.
It's just a little less than 1% of the Earth.
Okay.
0.6%.
Okay, well, thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Hey, by the way, Jim and David, folks at JPL have invited me to come by for a tour, and especially the group handling the deep... space impact program. So I'm going to go out there in a couple weeks.
Good.
I've never been there, so that should be something. Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey there.
Yeah.
I'm Katz. I'm from Boulder.
Katz, welcome.
Long-time listener. Love the show. I'm a big Velikovsky reader. I've read both Worlds in Collision and Earth in Upheaval twice. And I think there's some fundamental thing that's been missing in the conversation about Velikovsky's contribution. His field was actually psychology. And when he first set about to write what he wrote, what he saw was that it was massive information that there was some kind of cataclysm. Nobody else was talking about it. So he sought to try to explain it. And in Earth and Upheaval, if you look at it, it's paleontology that he tried to explain, although that wasn't his field. My understanding is that he was kind of laughed out of the podium because he wasn't speaking from his own scientific field.
Well, that's one of the reasons, sure.
And I think what he was doing, like von Daniken, like Charles Fort, was to say, hey, what about these things? And some of the things he said may have been outrageous, but it didn't seem like anybody was really taking what he was saying seriously at the time, and so much has been borne out since about there obviously were catastrophes at many times in history, and probably in the history of humanity. And I think that's what he was talking about.
All right. Who would you like to react to that?
Either or both. I'm loving both the guests and you, George, so you can jump in there, too. You know a lot about Velikovsky. I've been listening to you.
He's one of my favorites. Go ahead, Jim McKinney.
Okay, George. If people want to read something, sometimes the first read should be The Earth in Upheaval, because it is the book that talks about geological change, paleontology, and Velikovsky brings up many, many topics, and then, of course, he has his date bias of the Venus event 3,500 years ago. But if you buy the date or not, it's a tremendously interesting read. Like, I've got just some passages in front of me here where in Florida, they discovered human bones with mastodons and camels and other types of animals in this bed of sediment. And they had clay potsherds and the mineralization in the bones of the humans was the same as the animals, meaning they died at the same time. Now, whether that happened 3,500 years ago or not, like I say, I don't personally pick dates, but it's a very interesting read, and what it tells you is that something happened. Putting dates on things is very difficult, but something happened on this Earth. I just posted a little while ago on my homepage, there's a link right at the top now, and it's a picture, it's a big wall-sized poster actually. This was done by the U.S. Geological Survey in 1991 of the Laurentian Ice Shield, and this was measured from data on the ice field morphography, this location, and what it shows you is it covered the North American continent, but it went nowhere near what we call the North Pole now, and it went nowhere near Siberia. So at any rate, that's very interesting in that the Laurentian Ice Shield was the last ice age. So when was this? It was within geologically recent time, but Earth and relative to the caller's comments, Earth and Upheaval is a very interesting book in that he brings so many things to the table. And another thing that I'd like to mention out of that entire World in Collision, Earth and Upheaval text, is what Velikovsky called collective amnesia, the ability of whole societies to forget and change an event because it is so horrific. And actually, we see that happening all the time in modern society when a big event occurs and we put a label on it just so we can get it out of our mind and say, oh, that was that. And we're still dealing with many of these issues today, somewhat wrestling with them, but we always tend to put a label on something and put it away over there. And that's the way our brains work, and collectively our brains work that way. So I thought that it should be mentioned that collective amnesia was one of Velikovsky's great psychological realizations, as he was a student of Freud and psychology.
All right, David, do you want to react or we'll just move on?
No, just very briefly, I'll give Velikovsky high credit for imagination. He put together a very interesting scenario based on these synchronized global catastrophes between about 1300 and 2500 BC. The only problem is they didn't happen.
It would have been a great fictional book at the time. I think the heat would have been off him if he had presented it that way.
But he thought it was real.
He did believe it.
And I think he was quite sincere.
Yeah, I think so too. But do you think it was because of the technology at the time? As you say, later on it was proven he was not telling that he was not accurate. And you believe that he did believe it. Do you think if he knew about today's technology, he wouldn't be coming out with this theory?
I think he would not. I think, he wouldn't get anywhere with it. But how can I know?
All right, stay with us. Another half hour to go of phone calls, and that's it. And then at the end of the hour, I will release the vote. And there is someone who is a front runner here, but I won't tell you who it is. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, David Morrison, James McCanny, our guest, and your phone calls, final half hour. David, the story I just read about the planet Uranus and its possibility of pulling on the planet, is that possible?
That is total nonsense. It's amazing when there's so much interesting stuff happening, the crap that gets into, to excuse my language, that gets into some of these papers. It's crazy.
That's a big, and they're going crazy about it in Europe.
Oh, I can't believe that, frankly. Even if one paper published it, it would be obvious to most people that was crazy. Uranus is way, way, way far away.
I mean, that's what I thought. The fact that it's 50 billion or 0.5 billion kilometers closer, that shouldn't have a factor, right? No.
George, it's just not worth discussing.
Okay, let's go on to some calls. Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
This is Dana from Sykeston, Missouri.
Hi, Dana.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
Good.
I've got a question for David.
Yep.
Regarding the Big Bang. Hey, David, as a scientist, can you tell me, would you consider the Big Bang as a scientific theory or a scientific fact? And if your answer is a scientific fact, how would you measure that excluding the expansion of the universe?
Complicated question. I'm no expert on the Big Bang, but I think there's enough evidence now, the direct measurement of the microwave radiation and so forth, that we have to say something like that is a fact. It happened. Then the theory tells you, you know, how it happened, and there's room for differences there.
I see. It's just that the scientists based a lot of their measurements to the Big Bang. Let's just say, for instance, that the Big Bang is just a theory and it's not an actual fact. It never did happen. Wouldn't that crumble the scientific thoughts on everything?
All I can say is there's an awful lot of evidence that it did happen and no contradictory evidence right now. So at this point in time, it looks pretty solid.
Okay, thanks for your phone call. Appreciate it. Let's move on to East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Texas. This is Myra.
Well, Myra, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll just say on Bielakowski, at least he had the guts to think outside of the box. Sometimes mainstream scientists, they won't allow for that if it just doesn't fit what they believe in or they can't prove it at the time. So I'm going to step out of the box here again. And like the previous caller, I'm going to ask about the Big Bang. Has it ever, everybody walks around it, but no one ever says anything about what happens if one dimension merges into another. Talk about a Big Bang. Talk about Earth changes, atmospheres maybe being sucked away. You have no idea of what could happen then or how many times it has happened.
How about you, James McCanny?
Well, I take the opposite view on the Big Bang in that I have my own theoretical view of the redshift. And I mentioned that earlier, the induced electric dipole redshift is an internal mechanism for creating the redshift, which the Big Bang is primarily based on. I also think the Big Bang is a circular argument in that Hubble saw the redshift, used the special relativistic interpretation that meant these were moving away. In general, you look in all directions, everything is redshifted. Therefore, the universe is expanding. Therefore, if you reverse this, it must have come back into a Big Bang scenario. But if you believe, like many people do, that there's at least another form of redshift that explains these, like the quasars that occur near galactic nuclei that have very different redshifts. The quasar has a much higher redshift. This is a whole area of study. It's actually been printed in astrophysics journals recently, and ARP, the astronomer who has been observing these for many years, was actually a subauthor on the article, where they've seen a quasar that's right in the inner part of the galaxy that they're looking at, and they're saying this is definitely a quasar within this galaxy. So that this is an issue that goes back and forth. But frankly, as far as the origin of the universe goes, I don't think we're at the point yet where we can really definitively say we know the answer. And I believe the jury is still out on this. But this is definitely a topic that's going to go on back and forth probably for a long time to come.
All right. David, do you want to tackle that?
Nope.
All right, sir. You won't. First time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hi there. It's Steve calling from Highland, California.
Hi, Steve. Go ahead. And who's your question for?
Thanks. It's for James. Let me ask you, is there solar winds on the moon that possibly could have affected the blowing of the flag in the backdrop of the first man walking on the moon?
The solar wind blowing the flag. I would have to think about that a bit to understand what all of the implications would be. But, you know, there again, I believe NASA has some explanations for why that happened, and so I you know, I guess I don't have a comment on the flag blowing in the wind relative to the solar wind, or if that could have been a cause or whatever. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that question. Moving on, wild card line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. George in Rodney, Indiana. I was just wondering from a scientific, from microscopic or microscopic to macro, you know, where you seem to have things orbiting, positive and negative things, and capture seems to be a prevalent idea in microscopic, or electrons and protons, or, you know, molecules, you know, if you two parts of hydrogen captures an oxygen, it becomes water. Why wouldn't that theory hold, you know, in a macroscopic view, which, you know, with planet-sized objects or solar systems, and the capture just seems to ring through with physics if you take it from a microscopic to a macro view. What do they think about that?
Let me make a comment on capture. Capture is not my original idea. The original major work on this was done by a guy named TJJC around the turn of the century, or the last of the 1900s, and wrote two huge volumes. These were mathematicians who made extensive calculations, and since then it was shown that the resistive drag that they were talking about was not there, but they developed all the equations that then I adopted when I realized that comets were drawing in large amounts of matter. Their original idea was that it would move through a resistive medium in the solar system and slow the forming planet down. That sense has been proven incorrect because we don't have that much matter floating around freely in the solar system. So at any rate,
I was just going to say, it just seems, you know, with them studying electrons and protons and nucleus and
right.
molecules of anything, that it captures seems to be prevalent, you know, on the smaller scale.
The other situation, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have families of comets which have been captured, and this is an accepted concept in standard astronomy. And you see these. Halley's Comet is, I forget which group, is Saturn, one of the Saturn family of comets, I believe. But, you know, each major planet has major groups of comets associated with them that were captured. And they've seen comet orbits altered as they come near the major planets. So these things have been observed. And, you know, Dr. Morrison was mentioning Hale-Bopp changed its orbit when it came near Jupiter, those type of things. So alteration of orbits is a well-known and well-understood. The question is, how many members of the solar system were adopted later by capture, and how many were in the original solar system?
Does he believe in capture at all, David?
No, I don't see any evidence for it.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's absolutely impossible, but it just, that's not, there's no indication of it.
All right, thank you, George, for that question. The next up, as the clock is ticking, we'll go east of the Rockies. You're on coast. Hi. Hello.
East of the Rockies?
You got it.
Oh, hey, this is Mike in the Bronx.
Hi, Mike.
But aren't all the planets captured? That's my question. Aren't all planets captured?
Are they?
No.
Both. No, the planets in the solar system formed out of a spinning dust cloud, a circumstellar disk, it's called, right along with the sun, and so they all have the same basic motion coming from their origin, and they form together with each other and the sun.
And Jim, you concur?
My conclusion is that some of the planets are original, some are captured, and it's very difficult to know which is which. The Russians back in the 70s were doing statistical calculations in just mathematical celestial mechanics. And what they discovered is if you throw at random a whole bunch of bodies together, and this is not in the neat Laplacian formation where they're all already forming in circular orbits, but if you combine a bunch of objects at random under gravity, most of the objects get thrown out of the system, and the two or three major components are what are left. In this random formation, and they did it over and over again under many different combinations of circumstances, and that usually was the end result, and that's how they explained the fact that we have mainly twin and triple star systems in the cosmos, but no higher order systems. But so that's just, and what that would mean is then that all these smaller objects would then be captured at a later time and brought in one by one into neat orbits.
Jim, is there anything that really fascinates you about the universe? What's out there?
Actually, how empty it is once you get past our atmosphere. When you look across the vast expanse of the universe and you can see, I mean, there are dust clouds that move around as you're trying to view, but I mean, you can look to the edge of the universe and there is more matter between the ground and the top of our atmosphere, 62 miles up, than there is across the entire universe. So it's apart from the solid objects out there, it's quite an empty place. That amazes me.
How about you, David? What amazes you about space?
Well, the whole universe is fascinating. It's variety and all the things that are going on. But the question that fascinates me is life. Origin of life on Earth, whether there's life on Mars or Europa, whether we can ever find evidence of life on planets around other stars. That to me, frankly, is a lot more interesting than Velikovsky.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
Your health is good. That's good.
Life as well.
Yeah, life as well. Mine too. That's always good. Anywho, I had a question for both of your guests.
All right.
Anywho, I've been picking up bits and parts of your show since I've driven home. Anywho, it was about the acquiring of Mars atmosphere. Did I misinterpret that by any chance?
Mars atmosphere, a little bit more, please.
Okay. Well, basically, I had a little bit of a theory why it has an atmosphere and why it doesn't have very much of it and why it should contain an atmosphere even though it has very low gravity and only has about, 11%,
mm-hmm.
The mass and everything. I was thinking, my question is there any possibility that Mars may have lost its mass at any time? I mean, if you think about it, from what I've observed, Mars doesn't have very much more gravity than the Moon. I mean,
no, it does. I think it's like 1/6 of,
yeah.
of what we have. David, let's get into this with you. Do you know much about Mars? And,
well, yeah, it has twice as much gravity as the Moon, and it also started out with a lot more water and things we call volatiles than the Moon did, and so it's perfectly reasonable that it would have an atmosphere. But it leaks away over time. 4 billion years is a long time.
What do you think, if you have to speculate, I know you hate that word, what do you think happened to Mars? I mean, something created it to lose its water, its atmosphere.
I think it just aged. Perfectly natural that an object that small would eventually lose its atmosphere. And the real question, to me the fascinating question is, if life forms when it had a thick atmosphere, did it manage to evolve and survive as the environment deteriorated?
Well, as we get to a point, how about just a minute, no more than that, David, if you want to wrap up and give us your summation?
I think that we live in a wonderful time in terms of the exploration of the solar system and the universe, and I'm glad you're talking about it. I think that's a lot more interesting than Velikovsky and some of these other crazy ideas, frankly, because the real science is really exciting. At least it excites me.
How about you, James McCanny?
Well, I believe that the whole universe could exist without life, so I agree with Dr. Morrison that life is truly the fascinating, the biological aspect. We are the smallest amount of matter in the universe, yet we can look around and change it. So we're put here for a reason, obviously, and as intelligent beings. And relative to Velikovsky, I took on a very difficult role, certainly not a popular one, to defend Velikovsky, but I thought it was important to take on the purest aspect of Velikovsky and present it to the public because of so much additional information that people are using his name as a draw or adding additional material. So I felt it was important to talk on the Velikovsky side in the form of a purist as opposed to, all of the other things that people say add on to Velikovsky.
All right, well, very good. Thanks, first of all, to both of you. David, thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. And, Jim, very quickly, 30 seconds, no more. People are still sending things out on the websites using your name, mixing up theories, confusing people, right?
You're talking to me, George?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's a real problem. I just ask people that when they see this, to understand that there are people basically plagiarizing my work, claiming it as their own, and just understand that that's going on.
All right, and Jim, you'd be happy to know that 53% of the Coast to Coast audience believes in the theory of Velikovsky. 47% say no.
Well, I am surprised.
That's pretty darn close, isn't it?
It actually is very close, though. Yes.
53% say Velikovsky was right on. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, and Sean Lavasseur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition.